In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Some families were born into. Some families are made from the ones we meet along the way. Our families are built on love and traditions, the memories we share, and knowing that life is better because we're together. Pure Life, 100% pure quality water, refreshing every moment together. Visit purelifewater.com and discover where to buy Pure Life.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. In Christian-dominated medieval Europe, what did it mean to be excommunicated? How much of an earth-shattering punishment was it? And what can excommunications tell us about the attitudes of people in the Middle Ages? In today's episode, Dr. Felicity Hill of the University of St. Andrews explains all to David Musgrove.
Okay, so today I am joined by Dr. Felicity Hill of St. Andrews University, who is the author of Excommunication in 13th Century England, which is published by Oxford University Press. Felicity, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thanks for having me. Yes, I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. So first question, a simple one. What was excommunication?
Excommunication is actually common to various different religions, but Christian excommunication in the Middle Ages, and I'm, as you said in my book, is focused on the 13th century. But excommunication, there were two types, so minor and major, or lesser and greater. As you might expect, minor is less of a big deal. And it really just meant exclusion from church and from the sacraments. Now, obviously, in a Christian society, people were meant to go to church a lot. But it is worth bearing in mind that people weren't expected to receive the sacraments, the Eucharist, or to confess more than actually once a year in the 13th century. But still, not being able to go to church and so on was potentially quite a big thing. And then major excommunication was the more serious, and that's really my focus. And that meant not only exclusion from church and from the sacraments, but also from the communion of the faithful, as they put it. So basically all Christian society. So you were meant to be ignored, ostracized by fellow Christians. So this was the much more serious sanction. In fact, the most serious sanction that was available to the medieval church.
So this sounds pretty significant. You're focusing on the 13th century in your book, but does the sort of the broad sweep of excommunication remain roughly the same across the Middle Ages and across geographically as well as temporally?
There are definitely differences. Excommunication as a kind of concept goes way back, what is in the Bible, for example. So Jesus talks about kind of warning a wrongdoer in private first and then amongst a few people. But eventually, if somebody won't listen to reason, then you are to treat them as a heathen and a publican. And St. Paul talks in Corinthians about destruction of the flesh to save the soul, essentially. And it certainly happened in the early church, excommunication. But there is, for example, little evidence of the ritual of excommunication, the kind of solemn ceremony, until I think the 10th century. And there were differences geographically as well. One of the main ones is the areas of Europe, particularly where heresy was a big problem. So in the south of France, for example, excommunication was much more linked to heresy. So if you are excommunicated in that area, there might well be an expectation almost that you are therefore a heretic. And in 13th century England, that didn't have the same connotations. Of course, that's not the practice so much, but the kind of implications or the way it might be interpreted is different. And there were some important changes to the way excommunication worked, introduced by Gregory the VII. So this is the Pope in the 11th century who's famous for the so-called investiture contest. And he kind of changed some of the contamination rules. So one of the main things about excommunication is, as I said, it's meant to be exclusion from Christian society. And the way this was kind of, the rhetoric used about this was one of contagion. So excommunication would spread. If you talked to an excommunicate, you yourself then became an excommunicate. It was a contagious infection. And he kind of mitigated actually the rules there and decided, or decreed, I should say, the Pope, that minor excommunication was the consequence of communicating with somebody sentenced with a major sentence. So this was lesser than it had been in the earlier Middle Ages. And that was a really significant change because it meant that excommunication wasn't quite such a big deal. And the issue was that it was in danger of becoming an epidemic. Because of course, if something can just keep spreading, I think we're all well aware of this in these days, it can just keep spreading and spreading and spreading indefinitely. And so he kind of mitigated the rules. And that was a very significant change. And at the same time, he also allows some exceptions so that close family members, for example, would be able to communicate with an excommunicate without any consequences. So those were two really significant changes before the period that I'm focused on. And then in the 12th and 13th centuries, the codification of canon law and the big developments in theology, for example, the creation or the beginning of the universities meant that there was a great deal of thought went into law, and there were additional safeguards put into how excommunication could be used. By the end of the Middle Ages, the idea is that excommunication was used a lot more and for quite minor offences. The big one is excommunication for debt. So by the time we get to the Reformation, supposedly excommunication was used a lot and for really minor offences.
That's helpful. And the idea of excommunication as kind of a medical process that you mentioned earlier, I think hopefully we can come back to that a bit later on in the conversation. Yeah. So you sort of referenced in that answer the ritual of excommunication and how that came about, I think, in the 10th century, you said, I think. That sort of leads on to the question of who could excommunicate who and what was the actual process involved. Do we actually know much about what was actually involved in being excommunicated?
Yes. So what the main prerequisite for excommunication was having sufficient warning. So as I say, in the Bible, this was part of the thing, right? You warn first, second. So three warnings was the expectation. In terms of who could excommunicate, higher clergy, so you're not supposed to have a parish priest excommunicating, although I suspect they sometimes did against the rules. But certainly, I think sometimes people assume it's just the Pope, but absolutely not. So obviously the Pope, archbishops, bishops, archdeacons. And in fact, if you're talking about an ecclesiastical court, you could even get a bizarre scenario where a secular person is presiding over the court and technically could excommunicate, not as any kind of spiritual authority, but as a, because they're presiding over the court. But generally, a slightly higher churchman, so an abbot as well, or a prior, the Chancellor of the University of Oxford, they could all excommunicate. And then the process, yes, warning being really crucial. And the point of that really is that if you are being warned that you've done something naughty and you refuse to right your wrong, stop doing what you're doing or make amends for it, then you're being contumacious. So you are being disobedient to the church, and that was grounds to excommunicate. There are different processes, there are different types of excommunication. A most usual sentence where a named person is excommunicated by an individual clergyman, you would have these warnings. And then in theory, just in a court, I excommunicate you. The ritual then comes actually as part of the publicizing the sentence. And the ritual involved candles and bells, explaining the offence of the person, telling the congregation to ostracize, to shun, avoid the excommunicate, and warning them that their soul would suffer in hell if they didn't make amends. And candles were thrown to the ground to kind of and extinguished to kind of symbolize the extinguishing of the soul in hell, but with the unless you come to your senses and make amends. So it wasn't seen, it wasn't supposed to be this permanent thing. It was always with the ability to undo it. And I think we might come back to that. But the ritual, in theory, the excommunicate wouldn't have to be present. In fact, they shouldn't be present because they're not allowed in church. So the excommunicate themselves might be in court and hear it with a quite boring process. But then the publicization of it later on would involve a much more dramatic ceremony. There is another type of excommunication, which is automatic. Might not be worth going into too much detail because it's quite technical. But essentially certain crimes, and this is again a kind of early 12th century development, although heresy, it had always been assumed that you were kind of automatically excommunicated if you were a heretic. But increasingly more and more crimes were added to this list of things that the second you did them, you were automatically excommunicated spiritually. Now, the church would have to confirm this with a named sentence if they wanted anyone to actually treat you as an excommunicate. But in theory, in terms of your soul, you were excommunicated the second you did this. The big crime being assaulting a priest or a clergyman of any kind. But it took off and a lot of things. So in England, Magna Carta was in fact covered by this type of automatic sentence. But yes, the processes are a bit blurrier because presumably a lot of people were excommunicated without ever knowing it.
Right. Okay. So it all sounds quite dramatic, potentially, the process, particularly the ritual in the church bit. Do we have really clear sources that explain exactly what happened there, or are you having to make some estimations there?
Yes. So for the earlier Middle Ages, we have these great litanies of kind of curses that come into this ceremony. And they're really dramatic, and they say things, let him be cursed while he is sitting and while he is standing and while he is eating and while he is drinking and when he is walking. And they go on and on and on. Everything you could remotely think of doing. And some of them go through every body part you can think of. And they're quite dramatic. And we have ones that do exactly the same thing in vernacular languages in the later Middle Ages. There is a weird blip in the middle where there are no definite examples of quite such drama. And the question is, did this go out of fashion for a while and then come back? Or is it just an issue of sources and it was continuous? But even in the less dramatic periods, so there's a cursing psalm, Psalm 108 or 9, depending on which version of the Bible you're using, that was definitely used in this context. And even if we have the slightly shorter and doesn't, you know, they take quite a long time to name every single body part and every single action that somebody could be doing. Sure. But even in the shorter ones, that final sentence of, you know, let him spend an eternity in hell with the devil and his angels, and let his, so the Magna Carta of Excommunication in 1237 said, and let anyone who infringes this charter smoke and stink in hell. Which is, and then the chronicler Matthew Paris, who tells us this, said, and they extinguished the candles, and presumably they were maybe tallow candles, which are quite stinky. And he says the smoke really gets up into everyone's nostrils and is really quite, almost would evoke hell, the stinking and smoking. So this could definitely be a dramatic and quite scary ceremony.
Sounds almost cinematic, I suppose, in a way, the way you're describing.
Yes, in fact, the Thomas Beckett film from the 60s, I think it's not dramatic enough. It's all very stately.
Oh, right. So I guess all those big curses that would apply for major excommunications, as you yes. talked about at the start of the conversation, the minor excommunication, I suppose it's a bit less dramatic for those.
Yeah, none of this for minor excommunication at all.
Yeah. Okay. Were certain sorts of people more vulnerable to excommunication? Do you think? Was it certain classes of people or genders?
It depends a little bit on what you mean by vulnerable. So there are two ways of interpreting that. One is more likely to get excommunicated in the first place. And the second is how they might deal with excommunication after that they were sentenced. In terms of who's more vulnerable, I mean, I think if you look at crime today, men tend to be in prison and generally sentenced more commonly than women. I think that's still true. Women absolutely could get excommunicated, but there seemed to be less of them. And the classes of people thing is a bit difficult because on the one hand, if you are of a, you know, higher kind of political class, a ruler or whatever, you might be able to kind of pull strings, be able to get away for longer. And I think we might come back to King John later on, but he, you know, it's quite a long time before the Pope actually excommunicates him because there is a reluctance to, apart from anything, undermine the social fabric because it puts people in a difficult position if you excommunicate somebody they're supposed to be obeying. So on the one hand, they were perhaps more protected. On the other hand, they might be more likely to be in disputes with clergymen for there to be a kind of venomous aspect to a dispute that might result in excommunication. Certainly what we can say is that anybody can be excommunicated, I mean, except like children. So men, women, clergy, there's even a probably apocryphal story of a pope finally becoming pope and saying, oh, good, now no one can excommunicate me. So yeah, absolutely anyone can be. And then the second kind of interpretation of vulnerable is what happens to you afterwards. Now, if you are, again, a ruler, you might be able to kind of say, you're not going to treat me as an excommunicate or else perhaps threaten violence. So if you're in a position of power, you might be able to, again, live with a sentence more easily. But again, on the other hand, people might use it against you.
So that's very interesting what you just said there about the impact and how far people actually respected the rulings of the church here, I guess, which brings up that broader question of how integral to the general fabric of society the church and church teachings are. And this is quite an interesting way into it, I suppose. Can you talk a little bit about how far people actually respected these sorts of rulings, whether it was truly stigmatizing or whether people in some instances just ignored it and carried on? What does it tell us about the relationship between everyday people and the church that they were bound to?
Yes. Now, this is a question which I have to start with a caveat about the source material, and the basic thing being that overwhelmingly our sources in the Middle Ages are written by clergymen of one sort or another. And as you, if you, you know, think about it, there's no real reason for a clergyman to say or to write, so-and-so was excommunicated and then everybody treated them exactly as they were supposed to do and it was all great and he or she, you know, made amends and was absolved and it was all excellent. What is much more likely that they would record is that somebody hasn't been treated appropriately. So while we have far more records of the latter, of disobedience, it doesn't actually have to mean that nobody treated excommunication seriously. And what, when sources say that somebody sought absolution, particularly in some of the most valuable sources, for example, episcopal registers, so the bishops writing down a kind of memoranda of what's going on in their diocese, or I should say, not bishops themselves, but their scribes, their sort of secretarial men, they normally said something along the lines of, and so-and-so came to his or her senses and sought absolution. Occasionally, you know, you might get a narrative source like a chronicle that gives a bit more detail about actually what went on behind that. But within the church sources themselves, they don't say, oh, and they were ostracized and they were really upset by that. And so they sought absolution. However, yeah, we absolutely have a lot of sources that indicate that the community did not necessarily treat excommunicates as they were supposed to do. So you get, you know, so-and-so has been intermingling with the faithful and spreading their contagion, and the people, forgetful of their own salvation, do not fear to associate with this person. And also just lots of people who we know were excommunicated for months and years on end, and that simply would not have been possible if they were being treated as they were supposed to. So in that sense, we can say with absolute certainty that it was not something that generated automatic respect amongst the populace. The traditional view is that it was used too often. I would caveat with that with, if you look at the study of excommunication in other time periods, and indeed like Jewish excommunication equivalent, nobody ever says excommunication was used the correct amount, and therefore everyone respected it. It doesn't seem to matter very much how much it's used. Actually, people are always going to resist something that expects them to treat their loved ones or their acquaintances as though they don't exist, essentially, or to only chastise them. And I think we can all agree, if you come across somebody in person and you're meant to just blank them, it's really awkward to do that. And it's much easier for us now because we use so much technology to communicate, and not replying to a text message is very different to just blanking somebody on the street. And I think the fact that it comes from on high, from these ecclesiastical powers who wouldn't necessarily be, you know, a member of the community, and you're meant to just do what they say. And you might think they did something awful, in which case you might actually choose to shun them. But equally, sometimes there were quite petty reasons for which people were excommunicated. And it seems fair to say that occasionally, or perhaps more than occasionally, communities just said to themselves, I don't care. I don't think this is fair. And I think from looking at how excommunicates were treated, you can see some of this kind of minor resistance to ecclesiastical authority. Now, that doesn't mean that excommunication was completely worthless, because particularly if you did have something against a person and they were excommunicate, you've got a perfect opportunity to really take it out on them. So you were in a really vulnerable position if you were excommunicated, but equally, you might have people on side and be able to live until you really need to do something that involves the church. So excommunicates were completely unable to to prosecute in court. So if somebody comes at you to, you know, say, oh, you stole my property or something, you would have to be absolved in order to actually answer the charges to do anything legal. And of course, if you start to get ill, I don't want to die excommunicate and go to hell. So you do get, as you might expect, people are seeking absolution when they start to feel like their time is up.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The rhetoric of excommunication is that it's actually not a punishment. It is supposed to, again, make people realise the error of their ways and come back into the church. And again, some of this is the idea that really they've brought this on themselves. And if they could only, you know, we're trying to help them.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's go back to the question of absolution, which you talked about a couple of times. So you can get out of being excommunicated. You can be absolved. So how does that work? Do you have to go to whoever's excommunicated you and sackcloth and ashes and say, sorry, you're right, I've done a wrong and please stop this now?
I mean, pretty much, yeah. You have to be very, very sorry for what you've done. So as I say, the verb used is normally come to your senses. You have to go and you have to say how sorry you are and you have to make amends. So that's make satisfaction. So for example, if you stole something, give it back or pay the equivalent amount. And you would normally have to do some kind of penance. And sometimes this could be performed after the absolution. And if you didn't actually complete it, then you would be re-excommunicated. Mm. And penance it really depends on the circumstances. So you might have to go on a pilgrimage all the way to Rome. Or, in fact, for some crimes, you are supposed to go all the way to Rome to seek absolution from the Pope. Although it seems that normally actually he would delegate it and wouldn't actually. It's really expensive to go to Rome. And I think people often could say, well, actually, my wife and children will starve if I go off for several months and I might die and we're at war with France and so on and so forth. But you might have to go on some kind of pilgrimage. You might just have to fast or something like that. It was not uncommon to have to do penance that involved kind of whipping in around the marketplace. You might have to do 3 kind of circles of the marketplace while receiving this kind of beating. So churchyards and marketplaces, and you'd have to wear thin material so that in theory you could feel the lashes. It's very unclear about how much it was meant to hurt and how much it was just a humiliation. But either way, this was, again, another kind of public aspect of the sanction that was humiliating. In fact, there is some evidence. Mary Mansfield wrote a book on public penance a few years ago, a bit more than that now, in which she says that it might have been a deterrent to seeking absolution because you then had to go through this quite humiliating ceremony in order to seek absolution. So she says perhaps some people stayed excommunicate for longer because they didn't want to have to go through this.
Mm, okay. So how far was excommunication kind of a public measure by the church to keep the population in check then to make sure that, you know, to give the church a chance to show their power and to make people aware that they ought to be acting in a certain way rather than a specific action against individuals?
Well, it was absolutely a public matter. And this is one of the, I think, most striking things about excommunication. There are lots and lots of different source materials that you can look at to, try and find out as a historian about excommunication. And they often tell you quite different things. So you can look at legal records that absolutely never mention the ritual. You can look at some liturgy that doesn't give you any indication of the kind of legal processes. But almost everything indicates how public this was. Now, I mean, you just put it in the context of the church kind of asserting itself. But if you think about the mechanics of how this was meant to work, if you are saying everybody has to treat this person as an excommunicate, everyone has to shun them, there's no way of achieving that unless you tell everybody who this excommunicate was, right? So unless I say, you know, Dave is excommunicate, you must treat him that way, then no one's going to do so. So there is a very practical reason why excommunication had to be public. But yes, as you say, this is also to do with, of course, making sure that people did toe the line. So, for example, there is a rhetoric about excommunication, which is public crimes should be dealt with publicly. So this is, if somebody commits an offence and everybody knows that they did so, then the church has to excommunicate them because the church has to be seen to deal with this. And if they don't excommunicate them, if they don't make it public that, you know, this person did wrong and now they are being punished, then this is not going to be very good. People might think, oh, well, in that case, I could do this and get away with it. So this is very much about somebody has done something publicly bad and they must be publicly dressed down, as it were. In terms of the church asserting itself, I mean, and you know, you joined this distinction between, you know, it being about individuals and it being about society. That really does depend a bit on how cynical you want to be. You know, I mentioned the medicinal, or we have, actually, we haven't really completely gone into that.
That's the next line of comments. So let's jump into that, shall we, actually?
Okay,
So because you, at the top of the interview, you talked about it being sort of seen as a contagion in some ways, and it being addressed as a medical process. So tell us a bit about that. How far was it seen to be more as a remedy for people rather than a punishment?
Yeah, exactly. So, and this is where the less cynical aspect of kind of what it's meant to be doing is. So there were actually it's the rhetoric of it being a medicinal thing is really prevalent. But there are actually kind of two sides to it. So there's one which is about the individual, which is this person is not being punished. Really, the rhetoric of excommunication is that it's actually not a punishment. It is supposed to, again, make people realise the error of their ways and come back into the church. And again, some of this is the idea that really they've brought this on themselves. And if they could only, you know, we're trying to help them to come back into the church. So the medicinal analogy there is, and, you know, famous theologians like Thomas Aquinas or Bonaventure in the 13th century would say, oh, you know, but it's a bit like how if somebody has an abscess and they have surgery on that, that's causing them pain, but it's to save them, right? So it's to help that person. So excommunication is this kind of, yes, I know it's painful now, but this is all for your own good. And then the second medical analogy is the one of contagion, which is more like if you have an infected limb, you better to chop it off than to let the infection spread to the rest of the body. So it's a bit like the kind of idea behind amputation. But of course, at the end, the limb can be reattached if the person does it anyway. So that's more about the good of society. So the medical analogy both comes into a kind of we're trying to help you as an individual, but then also you are a bad individual and you're going to infect everybody else with your badness. So we're doing this to protect society. So in fact, the medical analogy kind of has two sides. So if we look at the first one, there is this, it is the duty of a Christian, you know, shepherd of souls to correct their charges. So it is possible to be uncynical and to say, you know, they really believe that they were helping people get into heaven in the long run, because if they just let their parishioners do whatever they wanted that was naughty, then they're going to go to hell, and that's a very bad thing. So if you take seriously this idea that you have to help your parishioners, then you're excommunicating them, yeah, for their own good. And there is rhetoric around this that if you are a bad shepherd of souls, then you're going to go to hell for not correcting them. So, you know, if the shepherd doesn't look out for his flock and the wolf eats them, then it's the shepherd's fault. It's the bishop's fault for letting these people go to hell. So there is a very uncynical way of looking at this that really does say this was about helping people go to heaven. However, of course, we do get excommunication used vengefully or for petty reasons or for kind of selfish, self-interested reasons. And yes, absolutely times when it seems to be more about appearances and the slightly more cynical thing. It is important, I think, in this context to be aware of the Reformation and the rhetoric used in the Reformation that was very anti late medieval Catholicism. And actually a lot of this has seeped into, I think, even to this day, it goes on.
Well, that's, I was going to ask you to sort of pin your colours to the mast there about having studied this topic in depth. Where are you of the cynical view or take a more generous attitude towards it?
I think as things go, I'm slightly more on the generous side in the 13th century, at least. And I think that's another important point that it might depend on when you study. However, I mean, certainly in the 13th century, there are plenty of examples where I think, you know, there was very unkind use or misuse as well. But I think as a whole, they really did believe in their own we're saving, we're helping people rhetoric, even if it doesn't always seem like a very nice way to be helping people, or it seems overkill. I mean, you know, some of the things for which people are excommunicated, you think that's eternity in hell for that is probably quite harsh. You know, nicking some herbs from a cemetery, for example, you think that's quite far. So it's quite hard not to be a little bit cynical, I think, when it comes to that kind of thing. But the point is that clergy can't inflict any kind of blood punishment. Clergy can't shed blood. There's very limited tools for correcting people that the church had, in fact. And excommunication was their number one. And you can see how almost accidentally it could quite quickly be the thing that they resort to immediately, because they haven't got anything else. They can't send people to prison. They can't, although excommunicates, in fact, could be arrested and sent to prison if they stayed excommunicate for over 40 days. But, you know, clergy can't say, oh, well, you should be executed for this and so on and so forth. So that their hands are slightly tied and excommunication becomes their go-to solution. And you can see how it gets out of hand quite quickly. But the 13th century is in England famous for theologians and right-meaning guys. I think that the next century on, there's a different brand of bishop. So yeah, I'm slightly on the generous side, I would say, but not too far, because there's plenty of reason to take the other view as well.
That's a really helpful insight from somebody who's looked at it, just to get a sense of how genuine people felt about stuff. I think listeners will find that useful. So thanks for that. You mentioned just sort of getting to the end there. You mentioned the 13th century, famous for theologians. It's also famous for one really big example of excommunication, which is King John, who we mentioned earlier, which is quite a different order of magnitude of excommunication. Obviously, he was king, and as you said, the implications of an excommunication of a king are far-reaching. So can you very quickly tell the story of what happened there, and then maybe we could spend a couple of minutes thinking about the implications?
Yeah, so John was excommunicated unusually, after quite a long time of having been at, not at war with the church, that's definitely not quite the right phrase, an argument with Pope Innocent III. And in fact, England was put under an interdict first. And this shows, I mentioned before, that clergy might be unwilling to excommunicate rulers. And Innocent III didn't want to excommunicate the king as if he could possibly avoid it, but John was very stubborn. And what was going on is Innocent III came to the papal throne in 1198. John became king in 1199. And Innocent III was young and confident and did very much set out to assert papal power. And this had come, over a century after the investiture contest, where papal authority, the rhetoric around it was kind of growing. And Innocent was really putting that into practice. And what happened is there was a vacancy in the Archbishopric of Canterbury, and it was quite standard for kings to kind of have a say in who became the next archbishop. The Canterbury monks, who technically had the right to elect their the next archbishop, chose one guy. John said, "I want this guy." And Innocent III stepped in, and rather than choosing between them, he did something completely unprecedented and chose a third person. And this was, from John's point of view, just not the done thing. So, you know, Innocent was very much asserting himself. And John said, "I do not want this." He was English, Stephen Langton, the guy Innocent III chose, but he'd been in Paris, and obviously France and England at this time, not best of friends, and he was this theologian, and he was basically unknown to John, and this was, John was deeply unhappy, but not without just cause, and just refused to accept this new archbishop. So Innocent puts England under an interdict, and this means that all ecclesiastical services are suspended, which is really unfair on the normal people who don't get to have ecclesiastical burial or marriages and so on. So that kind of goes on for 3 years, and then eventually Innocent excommunicates John. And John thinks, well, I don't really care. And he is not known for being the most religious of people. He, you know, would prefer to go hunting than go to mass. And in fact, then his bishops go into exile because they can't serve under an excommunicated king. And John goes, "Great, I'll have all the revenues from that. That sounds great." So this is often seen as a failure of excommunication, a kind of indication of how weak it was, because John just goes, "Well, I don't care." However, I think in some ways that misses the point, because what happened is John is excommunicated. He's getting on with things. But he's also somebody who invites enemies, really, and his barons are increasingly in this period getting angry with him. And again, this vulnerability thing. So at first he's able to say, "Well, look, if you treat me as excommunicate, I'm going to physically hurt you." But once his own men start turning against him, it becomes, because they can say, "Well, you're excommunicated. We shouldn't be serving you anyway." And the King of France can say, "I'm going to invade because you're not even a proper king anymore." The Pope never deposed John, but lots of chroniclers claim that he did. And that certainly would have been the next step to actually demote him from his kingship. And if that had done, well, in fact, the son of the King of France did invade in 1216. So you get the whole period that's the lead up to Magna Carta, where John is, you know, hemorrhaging supporters, and excommunication is a really bad thing to have on top of that, because it just gives people an excuse to rebel. And I think that's really important to understand about excommunication, is that, yes, it's the church imposing something, but it is dependent on how everybody else decides to act. So again, if you are popular and everyone likes you, you might get away with it and go, "Oh, well, we don't really, well, it's fine, we'll just ignore the excommunication." But if you're already unpopular, or you become unpopular, you are in a massively vulnerable position, because it's completely dependent on how others choose to deal with it. And so in John's case, it's actually really illustrative of that. He gets away with it for a while, and then it becomes a real problem when he is on the back foot anyway.
So suddenly, excommunication has got political ramifications, as well as all the social ones that we've talked about before. So, does John die excommunicate, or does he get himself back in the good books?
No. So he realizes that he's got to deal with this, and so in the long run, you see, the Pope actually, if we're going to put winners and losers onto this, the Pope wins. John backs down. Langton takes position as the Archbishop of Canterbury. England becomes a papal fiefdom. John becomes a papal vassal. And this is has been seen by both contemporaries and more recently as a kind of terrible, subservient outcome for England. But what it meant is that John has this incredibly powerful man on his side. So when the barons do rebel and the King of France is invading, Innocent is absolutely on John's side. And he excommunicates all of them. on John's behalf. So John does not die excommunicated. I always think the really unfair thing about the interdict and excommunication in England in this period is that John is absolved before the interdict's lifted. So all his subjects who've been living without ecclesiastical services for like 5 years have to go for another before they, and it's not their fault at all. But no, John is absolved and has to kind of be very obedient to the papacy and pay money every year, but gets a really powerful ally as a result.
Okay. And it's worth saying that John's not the only monarch who is subject to excommunication, is he? There are other examples of it.
Yeah, his contemporary, Otto the Fourth, the Holy Roman Emperor, he's excommunicated just before John. The really famous example in the 13th century is Frederick II, again, Holy Roman Emperor. And he is also deposed has just really massive disputes with Gregory the Ninth and then Innocent the Fourth. And that's a really big scandal in the 13th century and very much an example of excommunication being used vengefully. And there is much evidence from the time of clergy and laity alike saying, this doesn't seem very fair. And we're not sure whether the Pope is acting in a reasonable manner in this case. And it's an example of the publicity attached to excommunication potentially doing a lot more harm than good, because what it's doing is publicising the potentially unreasonable behaviour of clergymen.
That was Felicity Hill. Her book, Excommunication in 13th Century England, is published now by Oxford University Press. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.